used to go with my dad. You know, he had a marble and granite works. And part of that was tombstones in cemeteries after somebody had passed away. I'd go with him and see how he would meet and talk to someone who had just lost a loved one. And it was very impactful. He always treated everybody the same, whether it was the janitor or the CEO. He built relationships. His marketing plan was his phone rang because of his reputation, because of how he treated people, because he followed through with what he said he was going to do. And I saw so much of what I knew from growing up when I met Art Gensler.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Designed, an architecture podcast. We appreciate you listening. And once you're finished, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast, rate us, and leave a comment. Enjoy the show and have a wonderful day.
Hey, what is going on, everybody? Here we are again, bringing you another episode of Designed. I am your host, Aaron Prinz. Thank you all so much for continuing to support the podcast. This has been just such a great experience so far, and we have so much more to come. All the feedback and comments are just so appreciated. Shout out to DPS Architects in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You guys are great. And again, be sure to follow us on Instagram at designed.podcast or on Twitter at designedcast to stay up to date with everything we have going on. Today's episode is brought to you again by the Texas Society of Architects, such a great organization going on over 80 years of service to the regional architectural community, providing so many resources and events for people at all stages of their architectural journey. If you're a young person, or really if you're a person at any level of the industry looking to advance your career, you absolutely need to check out the upcoming 79th Annual Conference and Design Expo, which is happening in Fort Worth, Texas, November 8th through 10th. It is going to be one heck of a networking event, folks, and you might even learn something. There's going to be 3 keynote speakers, over 30 tours, 300 exhibitors, continuing education sessions, really something for everybody. Oh, and did I mention there'll be a number of networking parties? What? Including the Emerging Professionals Happy Hour, which is happening that Friday, so even if you're busy and can't take a ton of time off of work, you can still make parts of the conference. And the best part about it is if you're a student or if you're an intern, the conference is totally free. You have no excuse. However, you need to act quickly. Early bird registration prices end September 17th, so visit texasarchitects.org to secure your spot today. And while you're on the website, get your latest copy of Texas Architects Magazine. It's really a one-stop shop for everything you need to know regarding Texas architecture. This month's issue features their design awards, which you can check out and see the projects and the firms that are paving the way for Texas architecture. And if you're out of state, get out of your bubble, pick up a copy. It really doesn't get better than Texas Architects Magazine. Visit texasarchitects.org for more information and be sure to follow them at TX Architects on Instagram and on Twitter. Again, that's the Texas Society of Architects and Texas Architects Magazine. Go do it! Today is a very special episode. It's Judy Pesek, who is the regional managing principal at Gensler and overall just a wonderful, wonderful human being. You know, booking these podcasts, I send a lot of cold emails, and most of my experience is actually in the comedy industry. I've always had this strategy of kind of trying to skip the middle in terms of I want to hear from the people that are at the top, because ultimately that's where I want to be. And that was, it was Ellis Rodriguez in the Sacramento comedy scene. It was Tiana Kimball when I was at school at Portland State University. These are the people that were leading the class, and I really just wanted to be in the room to be able to learn from them. But occasionally, people aren't interested in being on the other side of that relationship, and they don't return emails, and they don't return phone calls. But when I email Judy Pesek, a woman at the highest level of the world's largest architecture firm, I'm sure she had a million and one things that she has to do every day, and I didn't really expect to hear back, and I didn't get an email back from an assistant or from an intern. I got an email within 5 minutes from Judy Pesek saying, I'd love to meet with you. And if you listen to her story and the emphasis that she puts on building strong, lasting, lifelong relationships, it's not by chance that she got to where she is today. Clients don't stay with you for over 40 years and follow you to 4 different firms unless you are undeniably special and amazing at what you do. I don't care what level of the industry you're at, this is an incredibly important episode for everyone to hear and to listen to, and to learn from her story. And if you're lucky enough to have just a fraction of the success that Judy Pesek has had, you're going to have an amazing career. Enjoy, everybody. Here we go. One grossing firm in the country, is that correct? As a whole?
Actually, in the world. And my role is, as the regional leader, is regional of the South Central region for Gensler, which includes Dallas, Houston, Austin, San Antonio. And I've lived in all three of those cities and moved to Austin in 2016.
Oh, so you're relatively new to the area.
To the area, but I went to school here. So okay. I grew up coming to Austin.
Has it changed a little bit since you
A little bit. Yeah. A little bit.
So with Gensler being as large as it is, when you're back in school and you went to the University of Texas here at Austin, when you were in school, was this ever the plan for your career to be a regional manager of such a large firm? Or what when you're back, 22-year-old Judy, what were you expecting?
Well, in school, in the library, and this was a long time ago, there were always magazines, Interior Design Magazine. It was the big magazine, which it still is a great magazine. But Gensler was always on the cover. And we used those magazines for ideas. People dropped off old samples that we could use for our projects and things like that. And I don't know that I ever thought even I want to work for that company. It was just always inspiring to see the work, and they were always on the cover, and to me, they were always the bar of our profession.
So I went to school at Portland State University, and I went to school with a girl that had like an associate's in interior design before she pursued her degree in architecture. During all of her reviews, not all of her reviews, but some of her reviews, the professors would kind of say in sort of a condescending way, like, oh, you decorated this really nicely. And it's a sarcastic comment that they're making, and that happens a lot during architecture reviews. Can you maybe just kind of clarify what is interior architecture in your mind, or interior design in your mind, and how does that separate itself from the world of actual architecture?
Well, I think that's probably why I've been at Gensler for 30 years, because Art, as an architect, founded the interior design profession as we know it today. He believed in designing from the inside out. For many, many, many years, Gensler was an interiors only firm. And he tells the story that the way we got into architecture was clients would become so frustrated with some of the architects that they're like, well, you've done everything else. Can't you just wrap a skin around it? And it was the great work that we did in interiors that led us to our other practice areas, which now are really holistic, very well bundled. But it's about people. It's about changing people's lives. It's about making great places that have an impact on the bottom line and on people's lives. And they live inside these buildings, and they spend 80 and 90% of their time in these buildings. So they have to work. We've always had the philosophy, Art has, and I certainly have, that if you've done a project and it made the cover of Interior Design or it won an award or whatever, and the client wasn't happy and the space didn't work, then it's a failure. It's not good. It doesn't work. And so I laugh because I went to architecture school. Well, first of all, I went to UT because my dad did, and all my three sisters and my brother, so we bleed orange. And so I was going to Texas regardless.
You're wearing orange today.
And I was a yes. And I thought maybe in high school, I thought, well, maybe I'll be an attorney. Then I can solve all the problems in the world. And I literally came up to UT to orientation, and I went through several colleges and programs, and I walked into the interior design program, and I'm like, this is what I want to do. And I've never changed my mind. Now, when I was in school at UT, you could go two routes because it wasn't in the architecture school at the time. So you could go the what they call the architecture route. So you literally had kind of 2 years of architecture classes with the architecture students, or you went the art route, and it was more through the art.
And what would those two paths, what difference would they make at the end?
To me, the difference at the end was if you went the architecture route, then it was more technical. It was more you knew you... maybe not new, but you were more interested in like the corporate world than, say, the residential world, where you don't have to necessarily be as technically savvy. And so I knew from the beginning, I knew, just looking at it, that I wanted to go more commercial, not residential, because there's a very big difference. And so I selected the architecture route. And that's where I got to meet and had great professors. And really, in school, grasped the concept pretty quickly of designing from the inside out, how putting the best together to make a better result was the right answer. You know, I don't think it's, I'm probably going to get blasted by somebody for this, but I think there are too many architects that think they can do interiors. And there's probably too many architects that think they're planners. And there may be some planners that think they're architects. And there may be some interiors people that think they can do architecture. I don't know. But the right answer is the best of the best in each of your disciplines. And what makes a great project is when it works so well together and it's integrated. And again, I think that's why I've been at Gensler for 30 years is because they really get it. And interiors is not a lesser discipline of architecture. It's, you know, perhaps something that comes first so that the architecture can be better.
And what was it when you were at the orientation? What made you gravitate more towards the interiors versus just regular architecture?
The difference to me when I walked in, so when you went in the interiors, it was the interior spaces. It included the materials, the warm, touchy-feely, you could envision people in the space and what it could make them feel like. Architecture, it was more about, you know, buildings and curiosity. Well, I wonder what's going on inside of that building. So to me, it was kind of the best of both worlds.
So let's take a step back for a second. You mentioned you went to school at the University of Texas. But before that, can you take us through where you grew up? What was the economics like in your family? What did your parents do? And you mentioned, you know, your legacy here at University of Texas. But were you looking at any other schools? Or just kind of take us through your childhood and what brought you here.
So I grew up in Hallettsville, Texas, which is a town of 20.
Where the Hallettsville is that? Boom, roast it.
It's 2,300 people. I think we have 2 stoplights. There might be a third by now. My high school graduating class was 74 people. My chemistry teacher at the time was also the high school counselor and basically said, oh, you don't want to go to UT. It's too big. You're going to flunk out. And
those are very words of encouragement.
Words of encouragement. He was encouraging everybody to go to a junior college. I was just like, are you kidding me? And I was like, oh, I'm going to show you. It was just not a question as far as I was concerned. But going from a high school graduating class of 74 to UT
just
as a freshman
students,
was a pretty big jump. Now, there's one reason I loved it is that everybody didn't know what you were doing every day. You know, I couldn't go have a date and ride around the block with a guy that somebody wouldn't call my mother and say, I saw your daughter over it. You know, so it was like, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to be a number for a while. So that was refreshing. But I grew up 1 of 5. I'm a middle child. My older brother is a chemist. My older sister's a microbiologist. I have a younger sister who's a physical therapist, and then the baby sister's a school teacher. So
something good in the water in Hallettsville.
You know, nobody in design and architecture but me. But I think we were all kind of problem solvers. My dad had his own business. He took over his dad's business. So it's actually now passed down to my younger sister and her husband. So it's a third generation business in marble and granite works. My mom was the homemaker, you know, when you have 5 children, but she loved to write. She wrote for a local newspaper, wrote columns, things like that, and then otherwise did a lot of charity work. But we were a pretty tight-knit family with that many kids.
Were you all at UT at the same time? You mentioned your siblings.
So my brother we're all 2 years apart, and except for my baby sister who was 8 years apart. So there were 3 of us there at one time. So that part was a lot of fun. Football season was a lot of fun.
With Austin how it is now, there's definitely a mass migration here, and the city is just going crazy with the amount of building going on. If you look at downtown, even Rainy Street and all of this. What was Austin like when you were here during school?
Well, I used to do projects with a friend of mine who lived off Bee Caves Road off Camp Craft. And I would go out to his house to work on some of our projects, and I was terrified. It was a 2-lane road, you know, rabbits and things would run out in the road in front of you. I would not go if it was dark. And I couldn't ever find where to turn. Where is this Campcraft Road? And now, clearly you drive out there and you miss it because it's just quite an amazing transformation. So it was a college town, but it certainly didn't have the traffic that it has now. But it's still, Austin is still a great, great city.
Do you think, well, you probably know with being in meetings and whatnot, when is this expansion going to end?
You know, I heard somebody say, when is it going to get back to like it was? And it's like, you know, it's not. We're way past that.
You can't go down to the Broken Spoke and see, you know, Jimmy John that's there every Thursday, Saturday.
Yeah, you're way past that. I think what's fun is I see Austin developing into a very sophisticated city. I think pretty soon they're going to have to rethink that Keep Austin Weird. It's definitely growing up into a very sophisticated city, which I think is very exciting. It's unfortunate you drive out like Loop 360 even, and you're like, really? Who didn't think far enough ahead to just build overpasses to begin with? Why would you not do that? So now we're suffering for, I think, very poor transportation strategic thinking.
So let's get back to your story here a little bit. So you go to University of Texas. It's a 4 or 5 year program at the time?
It was a 4 year. Mine was a 4 year program.
4 year program. So you get out of school. Are you going grad school or are you going to work? Where are you going after you graduate?
What I did, so my junior year, I studied abroad with the University of Georgia. They had a program, and I don't think UT did at the time, if I remember right. And they had an interiors program with architecture, landscape, art, history, several. And so I was accepted to that program, and I studied a semester in Italy through the University of Georgia. I had 10 hours credit that transferred. And so my senior year in January, a alumni that had a firm in San Antonio called the dean, Dr. Brightman at the time, and said, you know, I want your best student as soon as they graduate to start to work for me.
Let's stop you for a second. I'm assuming that student was you. What were you doing in the studios that really, or in the program, that established you as that best student that someone would select?
I would think, I took everything really seriously. I gave it my best effort, no matter if it was just a small little project or a great big project. I'm competitive. So this friend that I was telling you about, we would always study together. But then at the end, it's like, okay, what did you make? And so, you know, it was a bit of a fun kind of thing. I was just very focused. I knew what I wanted to do, and I was very focused. I went and met with this lady in San Antonio, and so I graduated and started working. And she basically said, don't move from Austin because your first project is in Austin. So keep your apartment for 3 months because you're going to be doing programming. Well, at the time, I was like, programming? I wonder what that means. And so I went to get an orientation, and it was at the time, it was in 1978, and that was the beginning of Dilbertville. We were working with Southwestern Bell Telephone Company. We were going to be moving them out of private offices and putting them into cubicles. So I was going to have to go interview and meet with all these groups and get the information and set their new standards and do the space planning and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, okay. So I started doing that. And after I got thrown out of a few offices by some people didn't want to talk to me because they weren't going to give up their office. I don't know who sent you over here. You know, that was an interesting time. But it was a 450,000 square foot project. And I was probably naive to know at the time that that was a really big project first coming out of school. It was just a very fortunate thing. So I then moved to San Antonio, worked with Sarah for 3 years, and then moved to Houston in 1981, went to work there for a firm named Pierce Goodwin Alexander.
So what were you doing there in terms of your responsibility and everything?
I was a designer, a space planner and designer. So I was doing the space planning for the new standards and for Southwestern Bell, and doing the drawings and ordering the furniture and overseeing the installation. And so I was actually, you know, like a project designer.
Is that a normal amount of responsibility for someone right out of school, or do you think you were taking on a little bit more than maybe your peers that were graduating?
Well, I was clearly taking on more, but I didn't know it at the time. I just thought everybody does this. You know, that everybody was doing this. It really came to light when I think it was a year after I graduated. They put together a panel and had five of us come back and talk about what we're doing. You know, you've been out of school now a year. It was either a year or two you've been out. You know, what are you doing? And we were talking to the students, like to the seniors. And I was last in the row of folks. And, of course, one of the designers were doing residential. Another one was excited, was doing work in the library, you know, meeting with vendors and getting things set up for the librarian. And another one was clearly more in a assistant role, learning different things and things like that. And then it got to me and I realized, goodness, what an opportunity that I had had. And so when I explained what I had been doing, you know, afterwards, there's like the panel staying. If any of you have questions, you know, come talk to them. Well, the whole class was like lined up waiting to talk to me. And it was just like, well, how did you do that? How did you?
These firms you went to out of college, were they larger firms? Because I think students, when they graduate, do I go for the smaller firm that possibly is going to give me more responsibility? Or do I go for the larger firm where I might have to cut my teeth a little bit more? What were these firms like in comparison to where your peers were working?
Well, the firm I worked for, Sarah Reevely, it was 10 people. And that's all we were doing. She had the account for Southwestern Bell. So that's all we were doing. I never thought about, well, do I want to go to work for this firm because it's small, or do I want to talk to a bigger firm? I never even thought about that. I think a lot of folks coming out of school today, maybe they do think about that. It all depends on, you know, I mean, like Gensler's a big firm, but it's a very entrepreneurial firm. It's very flat. We will give someone more rope. Actually, the bigger challenge I see, it's there for the taking and more don't want to take it. I don't want that responsibility. I don't want your job. I want more balance. I don't want to be here at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock. And so I see a lot less people wanting to take on more responsibility.
In your opinion, you're again at a large firm here and you manage the region. Is that the way to move up, you think, is just volunteer yourself?
I think that if you come in, the younger folks that come in that are extremely talented and bright and take on the challenges, they can go as fast and as far as they want. They come in and add value, and especially if they have really good communication skills. And if they have good communication skills, good client skills, I'll put a young person in front of a client in a heartbeat. If they don't, and they're going to cause problems, and they're going to say something that they shouldn't have, and affect, you know, the client's going to get upset, and, you know, we can't do that. So it really depends on, and I think that's one thing. Schools are very... They have a very difficult job. They have technical skills to teach. They have design skills to teach. They have all this theory and stuff that has to be taught. You have to learn that to be an architect or a designer. Less so, communication skills, client skills, relationship building, the soft stuff is so important. I used to go with my dad. You know, he had a marble and granite works. And part of that was tombstones in cemeteries after somebody had passed away. And I would, as a little girl, I'd go with him and see how he would meet and talk to someone who had just lost a loved one. And it was very impactful. I always saw, he always did what he said he was going to do. He was a man of his word. And he always treated everybody the same, whether it was the janitor or the CEO. He built relationships. His marketing plan was his phone rang because of his reputation, because of how he treated people, because he followed through with what he said he was going to do. And I saw so much of what I knew from growing up when I met Art Gensler, and I knew how Art grew the firm, because Art just at some point answers his phone because of the reputation he built, his integrity, and how he services clients. And that's the secret sauce. If someone comes out of school and they're theoretical and they can't get wrapped around, I mean, they just get wrapped around the axle over design. And I had one designer one time, I'm not kidding you, she had 71 paint colors picked on a project that was one floor. And I'm like, really? Well, it's not quite. And I'm like, guys, you got to get out of the weeds here, and you've got to not lose sight of the big picture, what's in the best interest of the client, and you have to put their lens on. You know, you get some people that dig in and say, wow, you're compromising design. And I always say you're not compromising design. If you've met the client's goals, exceed their expectations. And you can do that. It doesn't matter what the budget is. It doesn't matter what the schedule is. If you're a really good designer, you're a problem solver, and you'll figure it out.
So you're in Houston. You're working for your firm, or the firm you're working for in Houston. What was the name again? Sorry.
Pierce Goodall Alexander.
Okay. What brings you over to Gensler?
Well, so I'm in Houston working for them, and they had a big project. This was 1981. They had a big project, Marathon Oil Company. It was 1.2 million square foot new tower in Houston. And I was the senior designer, so I was a junior designer on this big project for Marathon. So I worked on that project and got to know the client. I got to sit in on the meetings because he wanted me, the designer that I worked for, wanted me to, you know, take notes and listen and then be able to follow up, you know, quickly after the meeting. We were working on that for about a year or so, and we were getting to the point where some of the spaces, like the cafeteria, had, it was time to show the client furniture and things like that. We had pulled together, the designer that I worked for at the time wanted to take this, the Thonet chair, famous chair, and he wanted to stain it red. And I was just horrified. First of all, that you would do that. Second of all, I knew the client well enough from listening in those meetings that the client wasn't going to like that. I knew that. I made the mistake of asking the designer, well, don't you want to show him other options? And he said, no, because if you show him options, they might pick one. I want him to pick this chair. So now I had backed myself in a corner. I'd ask him about options. He said, no. So now if I go get options, he's going to get mad at me. But if he doesn't have options, the client's going to hate this chair. I know he is. So I went and got all these options that I knew I thought they would really like. I hid them in a conference room next door to the big room that we were in. So sure enough, in the meeting, he's going along. He's trying to sell this chair. And the chairman stands up. He goes, what is this? Are you telling me this? You're just going to put this red chair? You're going to put this chair in our cafeteria? And he goes, yes, it's going to be fabulous. And the chairman goes, I don't think so. And he kept trying to sell it, and I could see the client getting really agitated. So I left the room. I went to the back. The room was right next to there was a back door in that room. And I started bringing the chairs in the back and setting them up on the back wall. The client literally was about ready to lose it, and he turned around and looked at the back of the room. He goes, well, what are these back here? I like this chair. And he went and sat in, and he goes, this is perfect. The designer goes, well, yes, we thought we would have options to show you. So we got it approved. It saved the client from getting even further upset. But long story, very short, is the senior designer left the firm that I was with midway, right in the middle of this big, huge project. The principal on the project at the time assured the client, we're going to get you another senior designer, you know, on this project. Don't worry. We're going to have, the bases are going to be covered. And he said, I don't want anybody else. We want to work with Judy.
And how old were you at the time?
Well, let's see, 1981. And I was born in 56. So what would that make me? Early 20s.
So you have this huge project you're in charge of.
I have 1.2 million square feet that I'm in charge of. And a client who I felt like I really knew what made them tick. I knew what they liked. I knew how to, you know, here I was, but also specifying furniture for 1 million square feet. I was like, oh, I've got to write an RFP. We've got to put bids out. I've got to specify all this furniture. And I'm like, oh, so I wonder how you do that. So I was like, okay.
And there's no internet to Google.
No,
how to do
absolutely
it or...
not. So every page had to be done by hand, all the specs. You know, you get one number wrong and you get a blue fabric instead of a red fabric. I mean, it's a pretty big deal.
So are you sleeping at the time?
Yeah, it was very exciting. I just remember being so excited. I couldn't wait to get to work and I didn't want to leave. It was very, very exciting. And such a fabulous client that you just, you wanted to knock it out of the park for them because they were so great.
So you go from 25, you probably have very little to none professional portfolio, to having 1 million square feet in your portfolio. And is that how you make the jump then to Gensler?
Well, it was 1987, and I'd been with that firm since 81. And in 1987, the Texas market, in particular in Houston with the oil crash, was a very, very tough time. People were getting laid off. The work wasn't exciting. It was a very difficult time. The people that will remember that time of 87. And the lighting designer that worked on Marathon with me was from New York. And he said to me, he said, Gidi, he said, you would be great at Gensler. And he said, they're hiring in Washington, D.C. He goes, you ought to talk to them. I gave it a little bit of thought, not a lot. And I thought, well, you know, I'm just going to drop my resume in the mail to them. I did and kind of didn't think much of it. So then I got a phone call from him and said, would you come up and talk to us? And so I said, sure. So I flew up and interviewed, and their D.C. office at the time was probably 20 people. The firm had 7 offices and probably 500 people at the time. This was 1987. So,
which by any means is still a relatively large firm.
Yes, that's true. So I flew up and it just felt like a good fit. And again, my dad's always been a great mentor, Texan through and through, never lived anywhere else. My mom had just passed away in 86. And so I talked to my dad. I said, what do you think? And he goes, well, what are you afraid of? And I said, well, you know, kind of leaving home and, you know, it's far away. And he goes, well, what's the worst thing that could happen? I said, well, I guess I would get up there and I'd hate it. He goes, okay, so then what do you do? I guess I come back. And he goes, well, okay. And so I was like, whoa, okay. So I went up there, went to D.C. And I told myself, I'm going to give it 4 years. I don't care if I hate D.C. or not being in Texas or whatever. I'm giving it 4 years. In those 4 years, I loved the firm. Absolutely fell in love with the firm. I missed Texas. I missed my family. I missed, you know, my sisters were having babies, and I missed my family. And so in the meantime, the firm that PGA, the firm I'd worked for, had been purchased by someone, and it had become PGAL, and they were doing work in Washington for the airport. I got a phone call from them because when I left Hairston & Alexander in 87 and moved to Gensler in Washington, my clients followed me to Gensler in Washington. So I was still doing work in Texas or wherever they were, Findlay, Ohio, because they came with me to Gensler. So the call I got was, wait a minute, we tried to figure out where all these clients went and nobody wanted to talk about it. And then I finally figured out they went with you. We want you to come back to the firm in Texas, and we want you to lead our interiors group. So I had just made partner with Gensler at the age of 34.
See, that's amazing to me because there's, with how it's explained now to students that, you know, don't expect to make it until your mid-40s, maybe 50s, before you actually are in a role that you somewhat got into the profession to do, you know, so... And there's something about your story that I'm just like, Gensler, especially, you're competing 500 or 600 people, and now there's how many people are in firm?
6,000.
6,000. That's an incredible number. There's only so many positions to move up, and then you have so many people, I would imagine, competing for the same spot. So what were you doing that really got you the recognition that allowed you and enabled you to continue to progress inside the firm and become a partner?
I think for me, you know, when you can do more than just your job, I think when you can build client relationships, that in turn generates business. You are then someone that helps grow the firm and an office. People are going to take note. You can do that and still do your design work and work with clients. You know, we don't have marketing people in Gensler. We're all practitioners.
6,000 people. I don't know if you need it.
No, we're practitioners. You know, my client relationships back to Southwestern Bell is now AT&T. My first client is still my client today, 40 years later. I try to tell the young folks that doesn't happen by, your goal is not, well, let me get the client to like me, so I'm going to invite them out for drinks and I'm going to become their best friend. That's not what it's about. You earn their trust and you earn their respect because you make them look good. You add value. You do something that they're like, I can't do without her, and I'm not going to make a decision without seeing what she thinks about it. And that you're looking out for their best interest. And if you can become a trusted advisor to clients, and they'll follow you out the door to another firm, you can bet that you're going to be valuable. I could show you an organization chart. We have so many leadership holes in the firm that we could fill, and I can't find people to fill them.
Just because people don't want to step up and take that role?
Either they don't want to step up, or they don't have the skills, or they think they have the skills and they don't. It's like putting the right people in the right seat on the bus. If people, I've had people come and say, I want to be a project manager. I want to be a studio director. The skill sets it takes to be a studio director or a project designer is not their best skill sets. You know, their best skill sets are really being the technical guy, the guy that knows how to make buildings go together and do the details. And what works beautifully is if your talents and your skills and your natural abilities align with what it is you want to do. But if it doesn't, then it's difficult. You know, guys, I want to be a designer. It's like, well, really, we're all designers, but the ones that can really take the lead role in designing a building or designing an interior space or doing something are ones that have that ability in design to do that. And so my analogy to them is, you know, I've always wanted to be a country western singer. Well, I sing in my car, the windows are rolled up, and nobody's in the car with me because I would never make it as a country western singer. We either get them in the right seat on the bus, or they leave the firm and they go somewhere else where maybe they can do design, because maybe wherever that is, it fits better. So that alignment's really important.
Going back to DC, just made principal or partner. Are you coming back to your old firm?
Or? No, so I'm torn. I want to go back to Texas. The Houston office at the time of the firm was really struggling.
This is Gensler.
This was Gensler. And so I felt I had just made partner. The people that wanted to, there was another partner that had been a partner for 10 years and was wanting to go back to Houston. And they're like, we don't have room for more partners. We're still struggling. It was still struggling at the time. And so I kind of thought, well, gosh, if there's not room for him and he's been a partner for 10 years, then there's not room for me. I just made partner, but I really want to go back to Texas. And so I made that very tough decision. I left the firm actually in 91. After I just made partner and went back to PGAL and ran their interiors for the firm, for their Tampa office and Dallas and Houston for 4 years. Clients followed me back. So I kept doing their work. I missed Gensler. Loved being back in Texas. And so I was in New York at an event and I ran into Art. And he came directly, I'll never forget, he made a beeline across the room and he came up to me. I didn't know what he was going to say, but he said, we need you back and we want you back in Houston and I'm not taking no for an answer. And it was like the best day of my whole life. It's like, oh my goodness, this is so great. I can come back to the firm I love and be in Texas. And so I came back to the firm, this was 95, to the Houston office. And it was probably 28 people at the time. We grew to, I think, in 2001, in January, is when Art asked me to move to Dallas to lead the Dallas office. And when I left, we had grown as leadership team in Houston to about 200 people. 2001 was also a pretty tough year, if you remember. Mm-hmm. Not only did 9/11 happen, but it was tough even before 9/11. The economy was not great. And it was a tough time to, but in looking back, it was the best time to take over an office, was in a downturn, because by the time you got the wheels on and the market took off, you were ready to go with it. You weren't trying to hurry up and build it. You actually built it in a downtime.
Well, we had someone on here that talked about a firm they were with during the recession, and the person to the right of them got laid off, the person to the left of them got laid off, and they survived it. Can you explain, what does 2008 do to a 6,000-person firm?
We did have a slight decline in staff. We had some natural departures. We also had, you know, when you grow really fast because you're really, really busy, you know, sometimes you do hire folks that don't align or fit the culture. So it's also a time to sort of buckle back up and refocus. And every time that there's been a downturn in the economy, we've come out stronger and the growth has taken off even faster, either adding additional practice areas and expertise, but we've come out of every single downturn stronger than we were when we went into.
there's this, I think we live in like a boutique-y type of culture where people like the small town mom and pop shop that does high-end design when it comes to architecture. But you're also in school, there's the corporate firm versus the boutique architecture firm. Where's your stance on that? I mean, I have a feeling you have, you're leaning one way or another. But what do you say to those people that say, I don't want to go work for a 6,000-person firm, that's too big for me?
Because well, I just lost an extremely talented young person that I wanted to come to work for us so badly and went to work for a more boutique firm. Again, because in their mind, it was, well, I'm going to get to do more design work quicker, or I'm going to get to do this. I say two things. First of all, I think that's a misnomer. I think it truly depends on that person. There is more opportunity in a big firm than people think. We have never been the firm where you come in the first 6 weeks you're going to draw door details. That's just not who Gensler's ever been. So there's more opportunity than ever. We're broken down into studios of, 20 people per studio, and your studio, but they work together and share experts and share staff. So it still feels like a small family, and it's still a huge opportunity to work on projects and do as much as you want to do and be in front of a client. Again, if you have those skills, I think that I would say to someone coming out of school that the mentorship and the ability to get mentored by a multitude of people coming into a firm like Gensler is just tremendous. The opportunity, so which to me would spur your growth faster. And then, of course, the stability, the long-term stability of a firm like ours and the benefits. And, art makes no bones about it. I mean, I'm going on over 30 years now. And he said, this is a perfect, you should be able to retire and be proud of it. And he's always taken care of everybody. We're employee-owned. The stability of not necessarily, the ups and downs are and the ebbs and flows, and one area might be slow, but now this area is really busy. So that real and not only just areas within an office, but within the firm. So our approach from the one firm, when Houston was down, San Francisco and Chicago were busy. So we had at one time 24 people from our Houston office working in 6 of our other offices. They didn't lose their job. And as a matter of fact, they got excited. Well, I get to go to San Francisco. I get to go to New York. I get to go to Chicago. I get to go to Shanghai. And so the beauty of working across boundaries is just such a benefit. But it is. It's very difficult to explain to someone who maybe thinks from a boutique mindset that the big, scary firm is not a good thing. It can be a really good thing.
And I think you're owed a congratulations. You just won the Woman of Influence Award, right?
Thank you.
Just a couple days ago. And you're also named a fellow for the International Interior Design Association. Explain what that means to you.
Well, I laughed at the fellow. I said, that means you're old. But no, it's the highest honor in our profession. It meant tremendous to me. But what it really means is it means that I pay forward. I love to mentor young students, so it means I have a bigger responsibility now in what I owe the profession. So I need to give back, and I love doing that. Yesterday was the Women of Influence. I was totally taken aback and surprised and honored and everything else. It was a tremendous event. So now I sit back and feel like, okay, what does that mean? How do I pay that forward? What do I do with that to make it better?
Your proudest moment in architecture?
There's so many. I think that my proudest moment, I believe that when the water rises, all the boats rise. And my proudest moment is when I see one of my employees or somebody I'm mentoring get promoted. I see their career advancing. I love to help other people succeed.
Your biggest setback in architecture, and how did you use it to motivate yourself to get to where you are today?
Well, I think the biggest setback was when I moved to Dallas and they asked me to take over the office, and I got there and found out that it was really in disarray. We had clients that were upset. We didn't have our I's and T's dotted, and there weren't contracts in the files and things like that. And it took a really good 2 years of digging out and, you know, going back and repairing relationships and, you know, hiring talent. And sometimes you don't always get that right. And it was 2 years of, did I do the right thing by moving here to do this? Did I, you know, and many, many sleepless nights. It wasn't until I could finally see the turn where the office was coming together and we were starting to make money and the clients were starting to be happy and the relationships were starting to build on each other. You could see that light, that it was that moment where, oh my gosh, this was all so worth it. But the best way to approach that is I compared it to climbing Mount Everest. You just put a pick in the mountain and every day and you just keep putting a pick in and going up and you don't look down and you don't look up. You just keep putting a pick in the mountain until you get to the top of the mountain and then it's okay to look down. And then you're like, okay, I got to go to the next mountain.
What advice would you have for the little girl growing up in small town in the middle of nowhere, Texas, that wants to have the type of career that you've had?
Just go for it. Be fearless, but work hard. You know, work smart. I think one of the things I see a lot sometimes is people want it too easy. It's not, I don't have any boundaries on, if somebody comes in and they're right out of school and they're partner material in 2 years, I'm saying go for it. The problem comes in is when they want it, but they haven't earned it. And you have to, every day you have to earn the respect of your fellow workers. You have to earn the respect of your clients. You have to work hard. You have to work smart. And I just say go for it. My dad just passed away last year, and we set up a scholarship for him in his name at UT through the Alumni Center. And we put parameters around it that the scholarship would go to apply from a small town with a graduating class of less than 100 people that wanted to attend UT. And so the first award is this year. I'm actually going to the banquet next Thursday anyway, September 6th, to meet the young man that's receiving the scholarship. And so I'm so excited about that. I can't encourage, whether it's small town, but I think small town, if you compare it, you were just talking about kids wanting to go to work for boutique as opposed to a big firm. I think a lot of people in small towns think, oh, I can't. It's like the counselor telling me, you know, don't go to big school, you're going to flunk out. I mean, it's like, that's not what we ought to be doing. We ought to be encouraging them and helping them and pulling them up. And so I think that's all great.
Judy Pesek, I appreciate your time so much. I hope this was great for you. I really enjoyed it. And just thank you so much for sitting down with me.
Great fun.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to an episode of Designed, an architecture podcast. We'd appreciate you taking a moment to subscribe to us, rate us, and leave us a comment. Have a wonderful day.